Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Metz.
Hello and welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday. I'm Jeremy Maggs with 30 minutes packed with the latest South African and global news. We are live right now and then you can catch us later as a podcast. Stay tuned for interviews with key business and political figures, prominent newsmakers and leading experts delivering all the essential updates you need fast and focused. It's Tuesday, the 1st of October. On our program today, are we headed for an all-out war as the Middle Eastern conflict escalates? An expert weighs in on the growing case for tourism as a key economic driver. How private investment in the STEM sector students could help end the cycle of poverty and give the country the skills it urgently needs. And clashes between Rondebosch residents and the city of Cape Town due to land earmarked for social housing. What is the end game, we ask? The Middle East has long been a region on the brink of conflict, but recent events have escalated tensions to an unprecedented level. The Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's decision to launch airstrikes targeting a senior Hezbollah commander in Beirut has raised the stakes dramatically. With mounting retaliatory threats from Iran and Hezbollah, as well as increasing regional instability, the question now is whether the region is on the verge of an all-out war. And joining me today to discuss that is well-known Middle East analyst Naeem Jinnah, Executive Director of the Afro Middle East Center. I hope we can discuss the complexities of the situation and whether a larger conflict is inevitable. Naeem, a very warm welcome to you, and the immediate implications then, in your opinion, of these recent airstrikes.
Well, as you say, I mean, the potential for regional war is there. Personally, I don't think that it will devolve into that, but it still is a possibility. If Iran does get involved, if the situation in Lebanon becomes worse, then you will have a regional war. At the moment, it is engagements between Israel and Hezbollah, both in the south of Lebanon as well as in the north of Israel. And I think that the potential for that to just continue for months is a more realistic one at the moment. But at the moment, I think that, you know, all possibilities are open.
If the latter is true, that will exacerbate an already existing humanitarian crisis in terms of displacement, with over a million Lebanese already fleeing for their lives.
Absolutely. I mean, the almost the whole of the south of Lebanon is now empty of its people. Many Lebanese, about one-fifth of the Lebanese population has been Syrian refugees over the past few years. Many of them are going back now to Syria, which, despite its own problems, seems safer than Lebanon right now. And many Lebanese are crossing the border into Syria as refugees as well. Those who are not crossing the border, and of course those who are crossing the border, their situation is not going to be great. Those who are not are trying to find safe spaces, particularly in the north of the country. But it's uncertain, you know, what is really safe in Lebanon. Israel's bombing campaign has been quite spread out. So the bulk of it in the south of Israel, but also the Bekaa Valley, in the north, as far as Byblos, a town in the north. So, people are sleeping on the streets, people are sleeping at the beach, in their cars, etc. Great kind of uncertainty. The human rights situation is going to certainly get worse, and refugee and other UN agencies, for example, have made that clear.
Is there an operational trigger point or a red line that Israel has crossed that might trigger a broader conflict that would involve Iran becoming more involved?
That's a very good question. I mean, one would have thought that the assassination of Ismail Haniyeh, the Hamas leader in Tehran, under the protection of the Revolutionary Guard, would be such a trigger. That didn't happen. There were warnings of retaliation, but nothing happened. And then one would definitely have thought that the assassination of Hassan Nasrallah, the head of Iran's most reliable and strongest ally, Hezbollah, that would trigger some kind of a response. But it seems that two things. One is that from the Iranian perspective, they seem to prefer a long war of attrition rather than quick, short battles. And secondly, that Iran really hasn't wanted a regional war. You might remember that in the past 40 years since the Iranian Revolution, of Iran and Israel being enemies, there's only been one occasion when Iran actually has retaliated directly against Israel, and that was in April this year after its consulate was bombed in Damascus. This despite Israeli assassinations of Iranian scientists, etc. And the reason for that is that they don't want a regional war. They don't think it will be good for Iran, and particularly its economy. They don't think it'll be good for the region, and hence again, not for Iran either. So they're going to try whatever is possible not to get into a regional war. They also, as they've already expressed, they also believe that that Israel's objective in provoking a regional war is to involve the United States in it. And if Iran gets involved, then the United States will almost definitely get involved, as Americans have said already. And that won't be good for the region, won't be good for Iran. So Iran is trying to hold off. I think the hope is that that Israel's army will get mired in the south of Lebanon for months, perhaps even years, and that the Israelis that have cleared out from the northern part of Israel won't be able to return for that period.
And the escalation, could it drag in other regional powers, either directly or indirectly, for instance, Saudi Arabia or Egypt?
If Iran stays out of it, then definitely not. If Iran gets involved, then it's not certain. Saudi Arabia, for example, the UAE, I think, will definitely get involved, not necessarily militarily, but perhaps funding Israeli efforts or American efforts. Saudi Arabia is a little more uncertain, but they might also get involved in the same kind of way. Egypt, I don't think, will want to be in a position where it confronts Iran, and certainly doesn't want to confront Israel. It's more an ally of Israel. So I don't think that those powers would get involved, the states, but there are lots of non-state actors that will. I mean, certainly Ansarullah or the Houthis in Yemen already are involved, and their involvement is in a way that they make their own decisions and they're not controlled by anyone else. So if they decide that they're going to send more missiles towards Tel Aviv, they'll do it without consulting even the Palestinians, who they say they're in support of, or the Iranians, who they might be getting some weapons from. Then there are non-state actors in Iraq, for example, and their targets will be less Israel and more the United States, if the United States got involved in the war. So from that perspective, you could see different groups in these countries getting involved, even if the states themselves don't.
Naeem Jinnah, thank you very much indeed, Executive Director of the Afro-Middle East Center. I do appreciate your time today.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Back now to the domestic news agenda, and tourism has the potential to be a gateway for economic growth, but only if we take the right steps urgently and together. That's according to my next guest, Ross Volker, who is the managing director of MSC Cruises South Africa. So let's look at what needs to be done, Ross, and also the potential of the cruise ship economy as far as this country is concerned.
Yes, I am fairly bullish about the tourism sector in general. I think it's one of those sectors that has a potential to solve a lot of problems. It is a resilient sector. People always want to go on vacation. They want to enjoy themselves and have a bit of recreation. So I think if you offer the right product and you offer the right opportunities, you're going to attract both investors, but also people wanting to go.
You make an interesting point about all stakeholders need to take the right steps together. Do you get a sense sometimes that there are too many competing agendas and maybe not everyone's on the same page, so to speak?
Look, I think it's very difficult in general to say that everyone can be on the same page all the time. I don't believe that that's possible, but I've certainly seen a very big turnaround in this GNU in South Africa specifically. The Department of Home Affairs has been very, very proactive. Met with Dr. Schreiber a couple of weeks ago. Very pragmatic, very good way of organizing things. And I think that shows in the way he's approaching a lot of the challenges. The tourism minister is a very hands-on go-getter person. And I think a lot of alignment is starting to happen. We need to do more, and I think we need to start looking at a national Indaba to drive tourism to the next level, because we are behind. We're only at 3.6% of our GDP versus a global average of around 8 or 9.3 in some countries. So we need to do more, but I'm certainly seeing some positivity in the GNU at the moment.
And to what extent, Ross, does the cruise ship industry or sector have a role in trying to increase that number?
Cruise ships for me are a force multiplier because of the volume of people that are being transported. So our smallest ship carries 2,500 passengers. Our largest ship is close to 6,800. You know, if they call into a port, the force multiplier effect of the economic impact is massive. And we really need to start harnessing that within South Africa. One of the biggest challenges we face is infrastructure. I've used the example before, 3,500 kilometers of Mediterranean from east to west. And you can name 100 ports that you want to call at. But in South Africa, we got 2,800 kilometers of coastline and we got 4 ports that we could call. So we need to do more from an infrastructure development, not only within the port facilities, but also in the hinterland to create opportunities for guests to travel to those places. But the cruise industry is most certainly a force multiplier because of the volume of people that it transports.
Ross, I've certainly seen some of the terminals in South Africa, notably the one in Cape Town, which is pretty impressive. So when you talk about infrastructure upgrades that are needed to make ports more attractive to international cruise liners, what specifically needs to be done?
So it's not necessarily the port infrastructure. Obviously, Cape Town has put a bit of development in. We built a 300 million rand terminal in Durban that services the wider community of KZN. It's not necessarily that. It's more around the destination management. So how do we transport big volumes of people within the city? Cape Town, for example, there's always a warning that goes out when MSC arrives because the volume of passengers we transport. So there's not enough infrastructure to bring people to and from the port expediently. And we need to grow the number of berths that are available so we can berth multiple vessels at the same time, so we can actually increase the multiplication effect of the number of guests that we're bringing in. So the challenge then is what do you do in Port Elizabeth, East London, other places, Mossel Bay, Port Nolloth, to provide attractive destinations for other cruise lines to come in.
And so much of that, Ross, depends on this much-vaunted Transnet recovery plan. Do you think that's starting to bear fruit, particularly when it comes to the big ports like Durban and Cape Town?
So, I mean, our terminal in Durban was a public-private partnership with Transnet. And I can tell you, I was involved deeply in the negotiations with Transnet. They were incredibly pragmatic. They were very, very good at their understanding of the infrastructure development and the need. So I don't think that the turnaround is necessarily significantly challenging. I think it just requires the political will to go and make it work and the desire from a strategic perspective to make it work. I think there's awesome collaboration happens between public and private partnerships, and it's easy for us to make that work.
Infrastructure is one thing, Ross, but the country also needs to take urgent steps again in Cape Town and Durban specifically, and I've had personal experience of this, to improve its safety and security measures to enhance the reputation as a preferred travel destination. I would contend that's not happening quick enough.
I would tend to agree with you. I think the biggest challenge facing South Africa is the security, but not only the security of foreign nationals coming in, but also our citizens. A happy citizenry and a safe citizenry is a positive one that welcomes people and allows us to grow the tourism sector. It is a critical sector that has to be addressed in terms of making sure that we have everyone secure in order for us to flourish, and it needs to accelerate. in terms of the protection of both citizens and people visiting.
Ross, give me a sense of what the cruise tourist does when they alight. I mean, they arrive in Cape Town or Durban, they might have a limited amount of time at their disposal. What are they doing? What do they want? And how much money are they spending?
Sure. Well, they're coming in to see the cultural experiences. So they're going to a lot of the sort of potentially cultural villages. You're looking at some of the wine farms in Cape Town. You're also looking at some of the premier destinations in Cape Town, Table Mountain, Windhoek Beach, those kind of places. I mean, Cape Town's blessed with such an abundance of natural resources. It's incredible. And then, you know, in Durban, even there, you know, going to Shishlui and up through to East Mangalisa wetlands, those are kind of the areas they come through. You know, there's a mix of tourism on cruises. There's local citizens, there's internationals, and the multiplication effect of internationals coming in is quite significant in terms of the amount of money they spend, because obviously the rand at, you know, now 19 to the euro, but 20 to the euro, makes it very sort of cost-effective to come to South Africa and spend lots of money, which is great.
I'm sure you watch that exchange rate very, very carefully. One of the issues I would imagine still causes a degree of problem, though, is whether there is a seamless value chain from arriving at a port and making sure that you can get to the destination, experience what you have to, and get back safely. You make the interesting point about arriving in Cape Town and wanting to go to a wine farm. Are you confident that enough work is done right across that value chain?
I'm confident that we're starting to see that work. I think we need to engage at a national level in terms of how we set the priority, not only from the perspective of the cruise industry, but also for the effect it can have on SMEs. You know, we got to transport, let's say a Splendid arrives in Cape Town. We got to transport 4,200 people. We can't hope to do that through one supplier. So there's a great opportunity for us to engage and to utilize the effects of SMEs and to multiply the effect of their impact on the economy. And for me, that's what needs a national discussion, because we need to look at how we accredit those, how we make them safe, how do we create the right road and rail network to allow that to happen. I think Cape Town is a unique situation. It does have that. Everything was within 40 minutes of Cape Town, traffic dependent. But, you know, places like PE, Durban require a little bit more infrastructure in the wider space to make it work. So we need to have a national discussion. I think I was at the tourism conference and I called for a national Indaba with infrastructure, Minister of Tourism, Home Affairs, Security, for us to lay down a foundation for our future as a tourism sector. Because I believe truly that it can be the multiplier effect to create a solution to our bad unemployment rate.
I'm going to leave it there with my thanks. Ross Volker, Managing Director, MSC Cruises South Africa. Thank you so much.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Everyone has something to say when it comes to South Africa's energy challenges, but few know the facts, the context, and the realities at the coalface. Tune in to The Current, the definitive podcast on South Africa's energy transition, from coal to clean ICE to EVs. Get the facts from the experts. To listen, follow Investec Focus Radio SA wherever you get your podcasts. Investment Bank Limited is a licensed FSP. T's and C's apply.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at midday.
Now, we are all aware of the staggering youth unemployment rate in the country, and beyond that, I think we're also very much aware of the worrying lack of young people entering the science, technology, engineering, and mathematics sectors, STEM in other words, and skills that we desperately need. Now, Next Engineers is a global career readiness program which is supported locally by the GE Vernova Bursary Program. Joining us now is Matsi Iso, who is the HR director for the program. And first up then, welcome. And what are the key reasons behind the high unemployment rates, particularly when it comes to a lack of interest, say, in STEM fields?
I think for me, the high youth unemployment, in my view, and this is a study that has been done, starts from at the time when they have to choose their subjects that they're going to focus on going through university. And what we have seen is that when the students struggle with the pure maths, they tend to really just focus on a maths lit, which then deprives them on the opportunity to study any degrees, undergrad degrees that are in STEM. And what we have seen is a gap that is continuing to widen in the market, where we do not have enough graduates that are coming out of the STEM degrees or even the engineering degree. So if we can address the issue of the career guidance at the early age, which I think this program is designed to really spike the interest at the early high school when it comes to choosing engineering as a career choice going forward.
Let's talk about that program in just a moment. But because we have this lack of graduates, that has a trickle-down effect on economic growth, does it not?
Absolutely, it does. Because what we normally get is that we have skill shortages in South Africa. And once we have skill shortages, then it has an effect on our economy. And that then means that we have to then import the engineers. And we currently have critical skills. You would have heard the Minister of Home Affairs talking about the importing of critical skills to address the gap that we have to come and help us solve our energy issues that we're currently facing in South Africa.
Matsi, you talk about the hesitancy as far as students or learners are concerned, but it's more than just hesitancy. It's also very big barriers they face when trying to access STEM education and as a result of that career opportunity.
Correct. You are correct there. And again, it goes back to the interest and the interest that is there at the school, which is the reason why we have partnered with the Department of Education in Gauteng. Purely just to make sure that we have the collaboration and we have the buy-in from the districts, from the principals in school, for us to be able really just to assess, do they have the right teachers that are going to teach mathematics and science? And if they do not have, do they have opportunities where we can bring our volunteers who are one of our, they mostly our employee, Givenova employees, to help the students to study and also do some practical work over the weekend.
There are so many initiatives like this. What makes yours different?
What makes this one different is it's a robust, it's a three-phase approach, which we start with a discovery at the age of 12, 13 years old. This is really at the critical age where we need to spike the interest of science to the young learners. And with this, we normally have experience that are very simple, but they are able really to collaborate and be able to identify with those experimenters. And with that, the student then want to know more. And once they get into grade 9, there is a week camp that we invite the learners to, where they spend the week in the University of Wits, and they are given challenges on the projects that are more technical, but also we introduce some of the soft skills, career coaching, and also inviting some of the career guidance professionals to guide them in terms of choosing the subject. By the time they get to academy, which is our topic of today, they've already gone through the 2 years of rigorous experimental and also training on the STEM, which then it makes it easier for the next 3 years that they are going to invest their time on attending the academy on weekends and over school holidays for them to graduate. And for me, what it does, it then gives them the overall of 5 years of really going through the science, the behind the science, and also just the training on the soft skills to equip them to be able to be successful when they go through university and also starting their early career in terms of looking for jobs.
I'm not trying to detract from what you're doing, and it sounds very laudable and noteworthy, but the reality is unless we increase the throughput, we're not going to make any real difference at all. So my final question is, what bigger role do you think industry or business needs to create or needs to play to create an environment that encourages young people to enter STEM careers?
I think it's a partnership. I don't think it's only the private sector, Jeremy. I think it really starts with the department in just making sure that they have the right educators, but also when it comes to the guidance at home, when the child is consulting with the parents in terms of the subjects that they are looking to take going forward, which is going to shape their career, their future career. So it's really a partnership. And I think in isolation of either of those partners, it will be difficult for us to really just, I would say, to move a needle and for us to make a difference. But I think it's programs like this, if we can amplify and replicate these programs and make sure that we touch more schools. Currently, we're only touching 15 high schools, which is not enough if you look at just Gauteng. But if we can have commitment from other stakeholders in just investing in such programs or similar programs to be able to then spike that interest on the STEM, but also just making sure that you bring the volunteers who have gone through the ropes and the students or the learners are able to identify and also, you know, want to or be aspired to take the engineering as a career.
Such a critical issue. I am going to leave it there. Matsi Isu, thank you very much indeed, HR Director for that program. Thank you so much.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
And let me finish the program today with metro tensions. Recent reports about clashes between the city of Cape Town and the residents of Rondebosch East over plans to release land for social housing are a growing cause of concern. For this reason, the Development Action Group is encouraging the city to ensure that it engages in what it terms robust public participation to air all grievances that members of the local community may have. Muhsin Hendricks is the executive director of the group. He joins me now. And firstly then, why has the city, do you think, struggled to implement a truly meaningful public participation process?
Well, I think the first thing is that the land is not going to be developed tomorrow. So I think what the city has done is put out the kind of tentative communication. But historically, I think the link to this issue, the question that you're asking, is that I do think there's a trust issue. I do think also that the capacity, both the warm bodies, but also the ability to interact and engage communities in a very meaningful way, is very challenging for the city. Often, you know, organizations like DAG has played the kind of a really pivotal role in bridging that gap between the city and communities. And so I do think that it would be in the best interest of the city to appoint some kind of mediator, people with specialized skills to do these engagements. And, you know, not just on this piece of land, but just all other pieces of land. That's going to be quite contentious in terms of an inclusive mixed income, mixed use development.
What's the general understanding of what social housing is in this context when it comes to Rondebosch East?
Yeah, that's a great question. So from DAG's perspective, you know, the affordable housing covers both the people who would qualify for social housing. So that is anything from 2,500 up to about 22,000. So, you know, the city has not indicated, and maybe that's part of the challenge, when they talk about the land being used for the affordable housing market, they've not indicated who exactly are they targeting, right? And so I think part of my earlier point around there is a need for not just a participation, but there's also a need for a education around it. Historically, people are concerned, right? People are concerned that when they hear affordable housing, they think it's going to be subsidized RDP housing. And what's linked to that is, oh no, you know, there's going to be devaluation of my property, you know, there's going to be overcrowding, there's going to be crime, et cetera, et cetera. Those are all the misconceptions attached to affordable housing.
But the reality, Muhsin, is that as far as the property owners right now are concerned, it's going to be very difficult for you to convince them to think otherwise.
I understand the concern around that, but I do think that if we are committed, if we want to see a city that's more inclusive, if we want to see a city that's more equitable, we're going to have to start thinking very differently about how we live together in terms of mixed income groups. It doesn't have to play out in a way that, you know, like affordable housing means that there's low quality overcrowding. I think there are very good examples of where affordable housing, social housing, in terms of its design, in terms of its density, it's, you know, it fits in with the urban fabric. The point is that if we can't find ways to solve that, where we're able to live together as different income groups, then we're never going to change the way our cities are functioning at the moment, which is a very exclusive way. It's very unequal. Middle class poor people are on the periphery, struggling to access, traveling long distances and so on. So we're going to have to find a way where we accommodate all of that in a way that's done sensitively, that is appropriate design considerations, that is appropriate financing to make it happen in a way that is acceptable to all concerned.
Let me ask you this question, and hand over heart here. Do you think the city of Cape Town is committed to the type of inclusivity that you're referring to?
Well, I think that this, in our interactions with the city, you know, there's definitely a commitment. What we're unable to see is at scale delivery of mixed income developments that is well located. And there's a lot of, I suppose, hurdles that we have to overcome. There's obviously the funding hurdle. There's also the political wall. And then there's also the realities that we are faced with in terms of the Rondebosch Eastland, which is, you know, the community, surrounding community, not happy with that. And how do we overcome that? And so that's why I think earlier I said that this piece of land is such a, it's such a perfect opportunity for us to have those debates around, you know, not just around the Bosch East land that's well located, but all other well located parcels of land within Cape Town that is owned by the City of Cape Town, but also owned by national government.
A lot of work to do here. Do you think this is an issue you can win?
I think it's an issue that we have to find a win-win solution. We have to put in the investment, the resources to make this a win-win solution, you know, because it's all eyes are on it. And I think in the interest of cities, not only Cape Town, but all other cities, all other metros, that if we are committed to break down those old apartheid spatial patterns, if we want to make a city that is more inclusive, more equitable, we're going to have to win this battle.
All right. Muksin Hendricks, Executive Director of the Development Action Group, thank you very much indeed. And obviously we will reach out to the City of Cape Town. Thank you. On our last online poll, we spoke about ESG principles, and 60% saying that it is a tick box in their company, a tick box exercise, and 40% of our respondents saying that better regulation is needed. And today, we did speak a little earlier about the potential of the cruise ship economy. I'd like your view on that. Do you think it's huge? Do you think it's overrated? Or do you think we have a problem in South Africa in terms of capacity to handle? If you'd like to participate in that, an invitation to go either to X or LinkedIn. That is our program for today. MoneyWeb at Midday is live at noon weekdays. We're then up as a podcast. Thank you for listening and goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at Midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.